From coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Yvette Thompson.
And I'm Natalie Rameth. We'll be your host for the next half hour of environmental news from across Canada and around the world. On this week's episode, Trevor Chow-Fraser follows up on the Obed mine spill. Chris Chang-Yen Phillips brings us a story from Iceland about how an extraordinary artist is making music out of matter. And later, Morgana Folkman investigates the apparent drinking problem in Canada.
The milk drinking problem. You may remember a story we ran earlier this year on the Obed mine spill. That's the massive coal slurry spill that flowed into the Athabasca River in the fall of 2013. In our last story, we brought you some voices from a community forum in Edmonton. The forum provided some answers, but opened up more questions too. So we've kept looking into it, and it seems like a good time to bring you another update. Here's Trevor Chow-Fraser with more.
The Obed mine spill. You might remember the details of this story, but just in case, here's a quick refresher. On Halloween 2013, a dike failed on the Obed Mountain mine site, 300 kilometers west of Edmonton. A torrent of water mixed with coal waste poured into the Athabasca River. Although early estimates were higher, experts now have determined that 670,000 cubic meters of coal slurry was released in the disaster. The Athabasca River is one of Canada's most important waterways. It begins in Jasper National Park, flows through 1,200 kilometers of Alberta forest, passing Fort McMurray and the heart of Canada's oil industry along the way, and continues on to join the Peace River, where those waters flow through Great Slave Lake, the Mackenzie River, and into the Arctic Ocean. Any contamination of these waters could impact a lot of Canadians in a range of industries and communities. Donna Mendelson is one of these people. She lives in Fort Assiniboine and is a member of Keepers of the Athabasca. This group took action as soon as they learned about the spill. Problem is, that wasn't until many days after it happened. In Donna's opinion, the government took far too long to make the spill public. And even after the news was out, they said there was no public health concern. They even initially refused to release results of water testing. Donna believes that government and industry were intentionally downplaying the severity of the disaster.
Initially, it was extremely difficult to gather media interest, and I'm not sure why, maybe because the government and industry were just downplaying the whole thing. A lot of people would want to know about it, but I think there's a pretty serious effort by government and industry to bury this kind of story. Comparable spills in other parts of the world have received far more attention.
Indeed they have. And that's one of the things that's so obvious about this incident. Why aren't we talking about it more? Mark Posch is a fish scientist at the University of Alberta. He calls the Obed mine spill the worst environmental disaster that nobody has heard of. How bad is it?
Yeah, so it's a pretty large spill, 670,000 cubic meters. Which puts it as the worst coal spill in Canadian history. It's the third largest in North American history. And to put it in perspective for other types of spills, it's roughly six times worse than the Exxon Valdez oil spill, just to put it in perspective. And the worst oil spill was the Deep Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That was roughly 750,000 cubic meters, so roughly comparable to that is in just sheer volume. So a very, very enormous spill.
The spill at Obed Mountain Mine is undeniably huge. And this is Alberta. We love big things. Big trucks, big malls, big prairie skies. So why isn't the public paying attention? Maybe because it's not an oil spill? It's coal slurry, which is what exactly?
Coal slurry is basically the byproduct of cleaning coal. So here, they don't use an ash process. It's cleaned with water, but According to the National Pollution Inventory, there were there's all sorts of chemicals, arsenic, manganese, lead, mercury, PAHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. So all sorts of pretty nasty things that can get into the food web.
So how bad is coal slurry compared to oil as a spill?
They're hard to compare, but I would say neither of them are particularly good in aquatic systems, especially from my perspective. I work a lot on freshwater fish. The issues are not just the plume itself, but the remnants of the plume, which is the sediment that is mixed in. So that has a lot of the ability to bind with a lot of these contaminants. So from a fisheries perspective, you know, oil would dissipate on top of the water, but the sediment will remain as far as what's left at the bottom. This is where fish spawn, and there are a lot of sensitive species that require really clean gravel for them to spawn in. And so having sediment in and of itself is a bad thing. Having sediment with all these contaminants in it will reduce the viability of the eggs. So from a fisheries perspective, it's a very, very nasty thing.
Talking to Mark, as well as experts from the University of Alberta Water Initiative, it is clear that coal slurry is a serious contaminant. What impacts will coal slurry have on the river? That, unfortunately, they've been unable to say, simply because the river has been frozen over. But now, 6 months later, the ice is starting to melt, and remediation measures will have to begin in earnest. I asked the Water Initiative's Tim Jardine for one thing he would like to see done to remediate the small rivers that took the initial brunt of the spill before it moved into the Athabasca.
You know, in the creek immediately downstream from the release site, if all the vegetation has been scoured from the banks, one of the things that needs to be done is those banks need to be replanted, right? Because we know those trees along the banks provide very important cover for fish. They cool down the water, they filter nutrients and pollutants that are coming off the land. So those trees that grow along the stream banks are very important, and right now those trees are gone. So that's one common technique that's used at mine sites to start that process of returning the land to its original state.
Now, just to remind you, those trees are gone because a wall of water and sediment knocked down trees in a 30-meter swath for several kilometers from the mine site. Now, that sediment is now in the melting Athabasca River. Mark Posch had some suggestions for how we can deal with that.
You know, when this freshet comes downstream, it typically will have a lot of meltwater and increased in turbidity, and some of these contaminants will bind with sediment. So ensuring that there's effective monitoring to help have safe and healthy drinking water, I think it will be a major priority.
Mark's concern here relates to what we learned in Tennessee, in North America's largest similar coal spill. Scientists found that some inert chemicals in the tailings pond later became toxic once released into the environment. Studies have shown elevated levels of arsenic in sediment downstream of the Tennessee spill, and mercury had transformed into toxic methyl mercury, a highly bioaccumulative compound. Because of this, we'll need to monitor the Athabasca for years to come. As the Water Initiative reports, however, Sherritt's current monitoring plans are inadequate. The government's Environmental Protection Order requires Sherritt to return waters to as high quality as they were prior to the spill. But they haven't clearly established targets to show when this would be accomplished. And the monitoring sites they've chosen are arbitrarily placed within a very small portion of the river, only a 100-kilometer stretch. Donna Mendelson is hoping Sherritt will provide funding for community-based monitoring all along the length of the Athabasca. Her group is already looking into it, but they'll need support.
I was recently told that it could be ballpark $1,500 for a full suite of analysis for one site for sediment sampling. I would imagine that there would be significantly more community-based monitoring happening if there was more support. It's the company should be supporting community-based monitoring the full length of the river. As the Water Initiative review points out, the consultant is not proposing adequate monitoring at all. What they're proposing is just, it's not good enough.
Thanks, Trevor. To follow along with the story, or if you want to take a look at the monitoring reports yourself, visit the website of Alberta Environment and Sustainable Resource Development. We'll post a link on terrainforma.ca. Have you ever had that feeling that you've been somewhere before? Maybe you've driven into an entirely new city and you get this weird sense of déjà vu because everything looks pretty much the same as home. The stores have the same shapes and sell the same clothes. The restaurants all serve the same generic food and people are listening to the same music. Well, Terra Informa's Chris Changyan Phillips took an adventure in Iceland recently. And he met an artist there who taught him what it looks like when what you make couldn't possibly be from anywhere else in the world.
When I was a kid, I remember playing the xylophone and glockenspiel in class and having no idea, not even wondering, where their wood and metal came from. But this isn't my music class. This is a converted grain silo made into a tiny art gallery in the village of Husafell. And this isn't a xylophone. It's a stone harp made of thin strips of rock. I'm watching it being played by its creator, Paul Gudmundsson.
A little bit cut out. As is many as nature. This is a nature. Yes.
That one's natural.
Yes. And this here.
I've come to Husafell, all dozen or so of the houses I can see between the snowy cliffs and the creek and the old lava fields. I've come here to see Paul Gudmundsson because I heard he was a decent rock sculptor. But that does so little justice to the magic of what he does. People at the local restaurant seem affectionately protective of him. They call him a bohemian. Paul has selected every rock for this stone harp from places he's walked in the mountains and canyons near the village. He taps them to see what note they make and chips away little pieces to tune them if they're not quite perfect. Perfect is a strange word to describe what he makes, though. This gallery and his workshop under a hill nearby are filled with rough stone carvings and sketches in watercolors and oils. Outside, there are women, owls, and spirits carved out of boulders, but Paul has left orange lichens at the top of some of them that suggest streaks of hair. He takes a big triangular bundle under his arm and leads the way across a windy field to the village church, with enough pews for about 30 people. Inside, we look at a carving of Christ on the cross that hangs above the altar, a crooked sheet of rock. In the carving, Jesus has these knobbly, pumicey knees.
How do you know that a rock will be good for a sculpture?
Okay. I see the idea in the stone.
You see the idea in the stone.
Yeah.
So like you see this and you see knees and then other parts.
Yeah, the Christ on the form.
So like Christ's knees you saw and then you built the rest of the sculpture on it?
Yes. So.
Paul's family has lived in the Husafell area for generations. His mother and father were farmers. He studied art in Germany and returned to this village where you can literally see in the church stone engravings that his ancestors made hundreds of years ago.
This. My forefather made this in the stone.
Oh, wow.
Very, very old. And this I made this and this. And this stone is very, very old. 16.
Oh, wow. From the 1600s?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've seen interviews with Paul, and I know he's much more eloquent in Icelandic than English. But he spends most of our time showing me music. This church hymn he's playing. He's playing it on a pan flute that he made from dried rhubarb. It's blowing my mind. I want to show you Paul's world because seeing his stone harp, his carvings, the paintings he makes by dripping ink onto ice and pressing paper against it, everything here just screams about this landscape. It made me wonder what it adds to our identity when what we make is so obviously grounded in where we're from. Thank you. In his workshop, Pal tells me that he makes this art partly to teach people to respect nature.
Það skiptir máli að bera virðingu fyrir náttúrunni, in nature. There's a very many people. There's many people think money or very much or kaput. There's very so in Iceland.
Many people, politicians especially, he says, just see money when they look at nature. He wants to call people, mobilize them to care about issues affecting the land. Standing in Powell's workshop, I started to wonder what it would do to our psyche if more of us made and experienced art that's part of our landscape. How it might change us, and what we find beautiful enough to protect.
Thanks to Powell Guthmundsson for giving us that glimpse into his life and work in Húsafell, Iceland. To learn more about him and see his stone harp in action with Icelandic band Sigur Rós, go to our website, terrainforma.ca. What's happening is coming up, but before that, we have a piece by Morgana Folkman. According to the Canadian Dairy Information Centre, Canadians drank, on average, 78 litres of milk in 2012. Think 20 of those big 4-litre jugs, or even a standard-sized fridge turned on its side and filled to the brim. And it's in this dairy product-loving country that a debate has sprung up over where we can get all of that milk for our table. Richard Griebel and Kathy Charpentier, relatives of Terra Informa's own Nicole Weert, have been farmers for over 30 years and did it the standard way until they had one of those classic moments of epiphany. Morgana Folkman contacted them at their farm in Castor, Alberta, and they chatted over the phone about their passion for raw milk.
Hi, I'm Richard Griebel. I've been into agriculture for 30-some years.
My name is Kathleen Charpentier, and I am Richard Griebel's wife. For this interview, I just wanted to share some of the wonderfulness of the journey that we've been on. And my hope is that people become educated and that they choose powerfully around their food. I would say that even farmers have a big disconnect from their food. It's not just urban people. And I think there's a great big distinction happening right now around food. And one of it is that we treat food as a commodity, or we treat food as food, and the premise under that would be that food is sacred. And so, like, I look around, Richard and I, so we've been farming for the last, oh, I don't know how many years, 30-some years. And even in our past, Morgana, like, Richard and I used to operate a feedlot. Not like we're pristine, but I have to say that it was in 1999, we heard Sally Fallon speaking at a grazing conference in Minot, North Dakota, and that completely changed the way we viewed food and the way we produced food. Like, what kind of farmers did we really want to be?
Can you explain the industrial model for dairy farming?
The industrial model is animals in barns being fed grain and silage, and they're pushed for production. They're selected genetically so that these cows give 5 gallons of milking, which is like 10 gallons a day. So it's all built around production. And these cows are so pushed that within one or two lactations, they can't do it anymore. Like, a cow you should be able to milk for 10 years. But what happens is when you're pushing a cow like that to produce, her mammary glands become so inflamed from overproducing that it starts pussing off and giving off a lot of mastitis. And so that milk, like, milk has a natural antimicrobial property in it. And what that does is if any bacteria get in that milk, it destroys it. But when you're over making that cow overproduce, there's too much bacteria, and the natural antimicrobial property in the milk can't deal with it. So that milk, the only way for it to be safe is it needs to be pasteurized. And people need to understand that. If you're going to drink raw milk, you better know how that is being produced. I would never go to a big dairy and drink that milk raw.
For us, we know and have created relationships with all the people that buy food from us. So I actually know that person's face. I probably know their children, their husband. Like, we know that family. And so we have a great sense of responsibility towards that. It's been the most enriching experience for us that we didn't have before. Yeah, and if people are drinking and choosing to have raw milk in their diet, they really, really must know their farmer. Mm-hmm. And they must create a relationship with them. That's one of the neat things about raw milk, I think, is it really helps draw this distinction. And I don't think we really think of it in terms of that, that there being a distinction. People are seeking raw milk, and it's out there, and it's black market, and it's really, the farmer is really taking a great risk when he does it. I think it's like a $250,000 fine. 3 years in jail. I'm not sure all of it. The demand is there. And, you know, we live in an agricultural community, Richard and I, mm-hmm. but we are like a little tiny oasis out here. All around us, it's all massive crop production.
Since we started farming to where it is now, it's just mind-boggling, the change. When I started farming, there was a lot of people out here farming. And now it's turning into these huge mega farms. A lot of people had maybe 1,000, 1,500 acres. Now there's 7,000, 8,000 acre farms. And it's all monoculture. There used to be a lot of mixed farming with, like, for you to have healthy soil, the only way you can keep the health of your soil is with animals. You remove the animals, and the soil starts to deteriorate. In my lifetime, I can't believe how sick our land is becoming. It's one plant disease after another. To me, that's a real sign of the health of the soil. Really, what it was really about is cheap food. People didn't want to pay for their food, and now they've got cheap food, but it's making them sick. And these are the questions, if you're going to drink raw milk, you need to know, or should be asking, are these cows on grass? Because it's the grass that makes that, one of the things that makes that milk so powerful. It's the chlorophyll in the grass, in the rumen of the cow, that's its stomach. She takes that, and all that microflora and fauna in the rumen make all these incredible fatty acids. You should say, how much does that cow produce? You want a cow that only maybe milks 1.5 or 2 gallons out of milking instead of 5, so that her mammary glands aren't overtaxed, and you know then that milk is really safe. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you're doing and why you're wanting to drink that. Mm-hmm. And raw milk tastes so good compared to this other stuff when you get used to it.
Can you describe the flavor difference?
It's like they're not the same at all. One is really, raw milk's kind of thicker and fresh. And the color is beautiful. I love it. We milk for our house. Organa, just so we can have raw milk. And the butter is absolutely to die for. And you want that cream that's so thick that the spoon stands up in it, and you can put a big gob of it in your coffee. It's like, oh, it's like heavenly.
if you guys don't mind going back to the politics of it, I'm curious, like, why you think Canada is especially stringent about raw milk?
Well, I think, first of all, pasteurization came in for a reason. And those dairies were filthy, the cows weren't being fed properly, and it was important that they pasteurized milk at that time. But now, I believe that we have the science to have clean raw milk.
Nothing's ever really totally that simple.
Yeah, because, I mean, just a small question like this opens up to how we live our lives, basically, nowadays. So
Yeah.
I started out in the industrial model. It never, ever quite felt quite right. And then when I realized what I was up to, all of a sudden, I had to become incredibly responsible for what I was doing. And to start producing high-quality food, it took a lot of courage because there wasn't a lot of support behind it. Sometimes I felt I was all alone out there. But I believe in respect and responsibility and courage, and I want everybody to start becoming more responsible and courageous, and that's what I'm shouting out. Thanks.
Thank you so much, both of you.
You're so welcome, Morgana.
You're welcome. It was fun talking with you.
Thanks to Richard Griebel and Kathy Chopinier for sharing their story with us. We'd love to know what you think about drinking unpasteurized milk. Write to us at terra@cjsr.com. Next on the show, we have what's happening in your neck of the woods. Listen up for environmentally charged events taking place in your city.
If you happen to be down in Toronto on the morning of April 26th, or maybe in the process of moving to TO for a summer gig, check out the Clothing Repairathon. Feel free to bring two or three pieces of clothing that are in need of a little TLC down to the Artscape Witchwood Barns, and one of the glorious, generous volunteers will fix it up just like new. They actually still need volunteers, so if you have a knack for sewing or maybe have a secret desire to create your own clothing line, throw the organizers an email. All of the details are available on repairathon.com.
At the end of the month, the University of Alberta hosts an international food security dialogue. Academic researchers from all over the world will be sharing their research on how food connects us all. Major topics include sustainable agriculture, gender, policy and nutrition, and Jean Lebel, president of the International Research Development Center, who will be making a keynote address. This three-day conference runs from April 30th to May 2nd. More details can be found at foodsecuritydialogue.com.
That brings us to the end of this week's episode for Terra Informa. Thanks to this week's contributors, Chris Chang-Yan Phillips, Trevor Chow Fraser, and Morgana Folkman.
Also, a big thanks to Chris for coordinating this week's show and Hamdi for taking care of our website, www.terrainforma.ca. Last but not least, thanks to Trevor for production.
Terra Informa is produced at CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta. Natalie and I have been your hosts today, and don't forget to tune in next week for more environmental news from Canada and around the world.
Bye!